Good morning, welcome to the Daily Connection on KDOV. 4 minutes after 10 o'clock on a Thursday, the final Thursday of July for 2003. Great to have you tuned in today, and great to have my two guests and two friends in the studio this morning, Matt and Chris. Matt McAuliffe and Chris White from Trail Christian Fellowship. They're both on staff there, and once a month they come in and enlighten us all on matters historical.
Well, what was that? Was that some sort of Freudian slip? Trail Christian Fellowship?
What did I say? I don't know.
It was fun.
Well, anyway. It's good to have you guys here.
We're glad to be here, Patrick.
You've talked about so many interesting things over the past month, and today's is yet another really cool, interesting topic.
There we go.
Probably some people don't even know this guy, but we're going to find out today. Who is it, fellas?
You've probably heard of him. It's Charlemagne.
Charlemagne.
King Charlemagne.
Charles the Great. Carlos Magnus.
Chucky the Big Guy.
Or,
okay, I think we can start at that point.
Carl der Grosse.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, everybody really, they've got a vague memory of Charlemagne, and he represents something huge. Basically, in a period of 800 years between 400 and 1200 in the Middle Ages, Charlemagne's reign in Northern Europe was basically the high point. It was the big thing that happened, and 400 years before and 400 years after, really was still kind of chaotic and dark. Okay, imagine, everybody's gone to see Terminator. If you haven't seen Terminator 3, you've at least seen the first two. And, you know, the smoking ruin, post-apocalyptic human race, you know, the smoke coming up. This is Europe after Rome falls, and the barbarians have laid waste to this entire place. For 400 years, the monks quietly, you know, dig things, plant the fields, clear the forests. You know, they're starting to bring things back, but it's not organized. And there are barbarian hordes sweeping back and forth, left and right. Well, at about, Muhammad dies in
632,
and immediately afterwards, Islam goes just smashing across North Africa, up into Spain, invading Europe. So lest we forget that the Crusades didn't start in 1098. So basically what we've got is everything is cut off. I mean, there's all the merchants have been killed off, and Italy's in just as bad a shape. There's no ships plying the Mediterranean. And it's up, really, the center of power moves north, and it's up to the Franks. And everything is so bad because there's really no cohesive kingship. Well, what happens? Finally, one guy, his name is Charles Martel.
Martel means the hammer.
Boy, and he earned that, because in 732, exactly 100 years after Muhammad's death, Charles Martel stops the Islamic expansion.
And that, by the way, is one of the pivotal moments in Western history, Pat.
I really think it's got to be.
It has always been considered as such, because had the Battle of Tours and then Poitiers later, as it pushed the Muslims back, had that not been successful, there's a very good chance that those of us who have our ethnic roots from Europe, we would have been speaking Arabic and would have actually had an entirely different cultural heritage today than what actually did happen. So Charles Martel is a very important figure in the history of Western civilization.
He's an amazing guy. I don't know spiritually. I don't know that he was even Christian. But the fact is, not only did he stop Islam, but he consolidated the Franks, all these little warring tribes, into a powerful military force, and he took land away from the church, which was the only real formal landowner in those days, and gave it to his lords, really giving birth to feudalism. So basically he's got the beginnings of a serious kingdom going on here, and does some initial expansions, stops Islam, gives it over to his son Pippin, who was raised in a monastery and is a Christian, a good Christian. And now Pippin is the first guy. He is actually anointed as king by Saint Boniface, as the Pope's emissary. So basically, here we have in Europe's history the first time a king is anointed as the official representative of the church. And this is important because Pippin's son is Charlemagne, who comes to the throne in 768.
So there's a heritage and a lineage. This is truly a great family. Mm-hmm. And, of course, Charlemagne, he himself he inherited the kingdom, and it was originally split between him and his brother. His brother dies real soon, and so Charlemagne becomes really the sole king of what we know today as Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, over the course of his lifetime, really over the next 30 years, he expands, through military conquest, even further, the borders of Western Europe. And so
he's just really Charles. I mean, the thing that Charles the Great kind of comes after his accomplishments, right? So he's just Charles, the son of Pepin, right?
He's just
now,
King,
right?
Charles, King of the Franks.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
King of the Franks. And this is in roughly
771, okay. Somewhere around there. That occurs, and he becomes really, if you will, he's a great military ruler, organizer, administrator. He holds Europe together, and this is Matthew described. Things are in utter chaos, and he really brings things together in a very great way. He expands the kingdom to the north, to the east, to the south. One of the big problems he had was the Saxons.
Oh, those filthy Saxons!
Filthy Saxons, you know. Anyway, they were always they were kind of a problem, and he actually brought them under control.
Do it rather violently.
In a violent way, at one time killed like 4,500 of them, put to the sword in one day.
But lest we run to judgment, we have to remember, I mean, these were guys that would do the same to him in an instant. And basically, when we talk about conversion by the sword, that's a whole another thing we don't have time for today. Primarily what Charlemagne was trying to accomplish here was just to get these guys to back off and say, hey, just don't burn my churches down, you know, don't mm-hmm. kill off my monks, just, you know, I beat you, I'm in charge. You know, it wasn't what we think of today as in terms of you have to obey all of these church rules. Really, that wasn't it. It was more of a political imposition.
Well, can I interject, Matthew,
yeah.
that
I wish
vast,
you would.
Yeah, I know you wish I would. really, the thing that Charlemagne did, he did convert people by force. Anybody who came into his lands
had to be converted.
They were Christian.
Okay.
We are Christian, you know, we are Christian people. We have conquered you, your land, your allegiance is to us. You are going to be Christians. But the vast majority of these people that, quote-unquote, had the forced conversions were polytheists. And so for them, you know...
we're just adding another god.
We're adding another god to the... You know, we're adding just another god to our pantheon of gods.
This is the Germanic horde,
this is
basically,
yes.
that
this
we're
is,
talking about.
Look at barbarians. A crucifix, throw a little holy water on you. You're a Christian, you know. But what made Christianity stick in Europe was the fact that they had a very organized system now of follow-up and teaching and catechizing of people. And several generations later, you know, what was imposed actually became really, truly the religion and the belief system of the people in that country. And that's why Europe became a very much a predominantly Christian people.
So all of Europe now at this point is starting to look at Charles and say, oh, gosh, you know, this guy's a big dog. I mean, we need to get on his good side and make things happen here. And, he had some bad times down going against the Muslims in Spain. As a matter of fact, just for fun, it was during his defeat in Spain and on the retreat that his good buddy Count Roland was killed.
Uh-huh.
And this gave rise to the Song of Roland, one of the huge, epic, romantic medieval sagas.
Sure.
And so he had pretty much stabilized a little bit in terms of his expansion, and then he gets a call from Rome. Poor Pope Leo.
Help, help, I'm in trouble.
They're beating me up.
Basically, that's what happens. Pope Leo is getting beat up, and he flees Rome and goes to basically get Charlemagne to come help him and to reestablish him in the papal throne.
That was the Lombards and the Byzantines beating him up?
Yeah, unless you think Europe is unified. Yeah. I mean, there's the Goths and the Visigoths and the Lombards and the Franks and the Jutes and the Angles.
It was the gangs in New York
over again.
And you got to remember, you got to remember that Charlemagne was almost 7 feet tall. Okay.
Whoa.
He's described as almost 7 feet tall. He was not a skinny man. He was 7 feet tall, but he was huge. He was just a gargantuan man, long flowing White blonde hair.
He laughed a lot.
Very, you know, very. The picture of him is he's a very huge, very good-looking
man.
But
you didn't want to get him mad.
And so the question is, you know, if you're in trouble and you need to go get somebody to give you a little help, he'd be the right person I'd want to show up with, you know, to have him talk to my enemies about what's going to be happening here.
So he goes down. He goes down to help Pope Leo. Okay, I'm a church guy. I might as well go down and help the Pope.
So he goes down to Rome to help him. This is the year 800, and of course, you know, winter starts setting in, and he decides to spend the winter in Italy, which makes
not a bad idea.
Makes perfect sense if you're living in, you know, if you're living in
Northern
France,
Europe.
You know, you might as well go and stay in Italy for the winter. And he's in St. Peter's, Christmas Day for worship service at St. Peter's.
Just kneeling down praying, mine and his own business.
And Pope Leo comes up and takes a golden crown off the altar and places it on his head and officially crowns him as the emperor of the Romans. And this is the beginning of an extremely new thing, an alliance between the church and the state called the Holy Roman Empire, which, of course, was to dominate, really, European history all the way until 1802.
What was Voltaire's quote about that?
Voltaire said that the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy, Roman, or an empire. But it sounded really good. It really sounded good. And what a heck of a thank you gift, you know, although Charlemagne was king of everything anyway. You know, this acknowledgement and this joining together was a very... very unique thing, but also something that was to dominate really the history of Europe for the next few hundred years. Because all you have this new idea going around is who is in charge of the people? Does the king derive his authority from the church, or does the church derive their authority from the king? Is God in charge of the king and the king delegates that authority? Or is God in charge of the church and they delegate that authority? And in Charlemagne's mind, he was directly under God, and he, of course, delegated the authority to the church.
I got the football. I'm running
and
with it.
The Pope, of course, said, "Now, wait a minute. You know, I'm the delegated authority, and I'm delegating the authority to you." And this became a battle after Charlemagne's death for several hundred years between the popes and the kings of Europe.
Let me dig up some dirt here on the Byzantines, okay?
All right.
Just for fun. This did not make the Byzantine Empire happy.
Because they're thinking, wait a minute.
What about our emperor?
Yeah.
And actually, this was a political ploy by Pope Leo, because he was supposedly allied with the Byzantine Empire. Well, one of the things that's going on right now is you have Empress Irene, who we affectionately call Mad Dog Irene, because after a number of years as regent, she decided she didn't want to give up the throne and burned her son's eyes out and thus eliminated him. But yeah, you know, she's a sweetheart of a gal. You know,
it beats gouging him out with an ice pick,
I guess. Well, anyway, I think Charlemagne actually offered to have their children marry, or he may even have offered his own hand to Irene in marriage to ally the two empires. And boy, it's one of those points in history where, what would have happened if those two had got together? But Irene was not having it and just, you know, dismissed it out of hand. But it was, she died 2 years later, or was assassinated, whatever.
Woulda, shoulda, coulda.
Woulda, shoulda, coulda. But basically, that was, there were bad feelings between Byzantium and Charlemagne's empire for about 12 years, and then it just became politically expedient for Byzantium to finally recognize the emperorship of Charlemagne in 812. And they finally did. And at that point, it was no longer a political ploy. It was a reality, and Charlemagne actually received it and accepted it. He liked it. And just for fun, lest we think of Charlemagne as this just striding, violent colossus, you know, beheading people left and right, he was very concerned with human issues. We're going to discover here in a few minutes he was very sympathetic with his peasants, built schools for them, things like that. He also actually negotiated with the caliph in Baghdad for the treatment of Christian pilgrims going to the Holy Land to see the shrines in Jerusalem and everything. Had a good alliance and friendship with the king of England, Offa, I think. I don't remember.
Sounds right.
So, I mean, this was a guy that was, I mean, he was good at war, but he was also, I mean, he wasn't mindless about it. He was very, very concerned with relationships and with gosh, humane compassion. He was just, he was very interested in people.
He did have a philosophy, and that was that the church was in charge of the souls of men, and the government was in charge of the bodies and well-being of men. And he was very benevolent towards both in his government policy and also in just his desire to strengthen and build up. He definitely did that.
Oh, my. It's actually turned out to be a good thing because he built, you know, chapels and churches, monasteries. He brought in monks and got things going. He really enforced ecclesiastical law. Now, he didn't really enforce it for the sake of the Pope. He enforced it for under his own authority as emperor. But he's pretty legalistic, as a matter of fact. He wasn't very interested in theology. Wasn't a good reader or anything.
He didn't read at all.
Oh, really?
He was.
I thought he did Latin.
No, he was. Okay. He was. Charlemagne was actually completely illiterate. Even though he was a man of learning and a man who had incredible interests and all that, he didn't read at all.
He tried a number of times. He tried to get it. He just didn't figure it out.
But bless his heart.
but he did enjoy, and he did have, books read to him every day. The great books were always read to him, and at dinner time. What would be typical of a king to, bring in a court jester, maybe a juggler, maybe a dancing seal or something. He didn't do that. He would have books read to him at mealtime.
You know, another sign that he takes this importantly is he went to great lengths to make sure that all of the liturgy, the chants, everything that happened in the churches in his realm was uniform. That there was one liturgy that everybody spoke. That the chants had the same words, which was just a real interesting unifying element.
So this is going all over northern France now. Yes.
He actually had a system where he sent out two guys, a nobleman and a clergyman. He would send out teams of these two guys, and they would just go all over the place and check things out. And, if they brought a bad report back from your city, well, you were
in trouble.
You were going to have a visit.
And, one of the things that Charlemagne also made a real priority was the biblical scholarship and interpretation.
Amazing.
He had brought in one of the best scholars in the world, who we'll talk about in a split second, but to do actual scholarship and revisions on the Bible, as there had been some corruption through the copying process. He brought in scholars for restoration of the Vulgate. The Vulgate,
well,
right?
Yeah. And here's something we don't. A lot of folks don't know is one of the things that had made it so hard to keep an accurate copy of the Vulgate was the incredibly complex writing, and so.
Under Charlemagne, he directed the new innovation, I guess is what we'd want to call it, of the minuscule cursive writing, which is the basis of our alphabet, the way we write today,
really?
Having upper and lower case cursive writing. And this was a major technological breakthrough, as big a breakthrough as the word processor would be in our era.
So what was it before this?
It was all capital-sized
letters, mm-hmm. And apparently
very
confusing to read as well.
Especially if you're an uneducated copyist sitting in a medieval.
And so this made for more accurate copies, but also allowed for the a greater rapidity in copying and disseminating books, which you got to remember, there was no printing press in those days. And so this allowed for there to be many more books copied and made, and that was a direct thing.
Boy,
that
brings us Charlemagne. That brings us to one of the biggest things he did. We've looked at how his military expansion really kind of solidified that Central Europe area, and we've looked at how he really strengthened the church, the structure, the institution, and made uniform the process as an institution. But probably one of the biggest things he did was, as Chris says, even though he was not a reader, my gosh, he got on the horse of educational development and rode that beast to death. He imported Alcuin.
Alcuin, who was a disciple of the Venerable Bede, if you remember us referring to him, who was one of the greatest minds.
Yeah.
If you're an English schoolboy, every Venerable Bede, because he was one of the great scholars of all time. And Alcuin was his disciple.
And
was brought in from England to be in the imperial court and to run the schools and the libraries and
oversee the intellectual life of the court.
Oh my gosh! Absolutely. Well, not only that, he brought with him the manuscripts, from the monasteries, which right at that time in Ireland and England were being wiped out by the new invasions of the Vikings and everything. So basically, almost literally, what we have is Charlemagne receiving the torch of learning and literature from the hands of the dying monks in the British Isles and carrying it over into Britain. And that's not a bad picture, because that, in essence, is what happened. They didn't do a lot of original scholarship or work, but what they did was they collected, saved, salvaged, copied, and brought together the literature of the human race. I mean, that's why we read, Pliny and Cicero and Euripides and Ulysses, in addition to all the religious works, Augustine and everybody. He did an amazing thing. He really made it powerful. He built a lot of schools. Gosh, there was the palace school that taught not only clergy and noble children, but peasant children as well. This is unheard of. Nobody's ever heard of this. Why would he do this? He really loved the peasants, though, and he really wanted them to have an education and a glimpse into a greater world.
And he insisted that the clergy be highly educated. This went from the court school, and then he insisted that every monastery start a monastery school, mm-hmm. where which the monks would be trained to be able interpreters of the Bible, to understand theology, and that was something that was also had not ever really been enforced. And so there he was bringing just a higher standard to the church as far as that.
Didn't he actually introduce the first post-Roman European use of the seven liberal arts?
Yes, and
we all give credit to the medieval the Renaissance universities for that. But
this starts with Charlemagne, the seven liberal arts, and this is taught first in the monastery schools. But this curriculum is carried directly and eventually becomes the university system of Europe. The university comes a couple hundred years later, but this is the foundation of what we know as the university system,
which is so much of what Charlemagne did. It's the sad thing is, basically, no one after Charlemagne was strong enough to hold it together. It was such an advanced thing that it was really an idea whose time had not yet come. There were still too many fractious forces and barbarian hordes right. wandering around. And so what Charlemagne built, I mean, once he had expanded, to the maximum degree, he could no longer give new conquered lands out to his nobles, and things started to implode a little bit. So it wasn't all his son's fault. But basically, things started to go downhill again. But the fact is that for about 100 years, the institutions and forms and the schools and the church functions that he enforced were in place long enough so that everything that grew up later basically came up in those shapes. In other words, it's as if...
Model.
Yeah, it's as if Charlemagne put the template down into which modern Europe grew. And that basically, in a nutshell, is what he did.
And so when you look at and some of the things that we take for granted, those things all are tributaries that came out of this period of time, really a very short period of time, but Charlemagne was a brilliant leader and a brilliant man.
Now, just for fun, there is, in terms of him as a Christian, we're not 100% sure. We think he was a very sincere, devout believer. He was also kind of a indulgent, carnal believer. But there's no doubting his sincerity in terms of doing God's work, the church's work.
Even a child shall be known by his acts. And so if you look at the fruit there, if you want to get
some pretty gnarly fruit, by golly. Yeah.
But once, I think it's always important to remember, because this issue comes up when we talk about Constantine.
Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to bring the issue up, we could go back to some of the biblical kings as well, who had forays with women. We've got to remember that a king is a king. And with the great power always comes the other problems of weak. Other
Nonsense.
Weaknesses.
If you examine my life under a microscope, you'd find it perfectly clean and.
I'm almost certain of that, Matthew. But anyway, Charlemagne died in the year 814 and is buried in the Cathedral of Aachen, which he actually financed and helped the building of that cathedral in his lifetime, and that's in modern day Germany.
But he put his stamp on the church and on Europe and on the development of civilization ever since.
Well, you guys, thanks for the look into the life of Charlemagne, a great man certainly in family history and the history of Europe. Matt McAuliffe's been here and Chris White today on the Daily Connection, and we're going to do this in another month. We do it on the last Thursday of each month. And so thanks again, fellas, and stay tuned because In Touch is coming up next with Charles Stanley, followed by David Jeremiah and our own pal Rick Boy after that. Lord bless your day.